Fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety, and those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force with your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors, leaders, and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is brought to you by Five Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission. First responders helping each other. And our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, your best bet for fire service tick training. And by the Firehouse Tribune, where you can expand your horizons in emergency services and learn to work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. And our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes, Nestor Bars, the amazing new hand tool for the fire service, EFT Corporation, 40 plus years of innovation in donation and payment processing solutions, 911lifestyle.com, first responder burnout prevention and improved health, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those headphones or turn up those speakers. The Five Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green. Happy to be here with you and happy to have you here with us. Today, my guest is a friend, a brother firefighter, and more interesting than put that together is the fact that he is also a fire protection system engineer. And we're going to hear from my good friend, Captain E.J. Henninger, in just a few moments. And we hope that you enjoy what you're listening to in this audio podcast. And you know we have our videos up on our YouTube channel at the number 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. And you can go to our website if you like this podcast. And we have our entire library is available on our website. All our audios are there, and that's over 200. And you can just go to our website at https://www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org and just type and hit the podcast tab on the horizontal menu on top, and that will take you to our library and you can listen and binge to your heart's content. Also, while you're on the website, we hope you'll take a moment to sign up for our newsletter. I just started editing one this week for the holiday season, and we do not send you spam. We do not sell or give away your email addresses. We protect them to the best of our ability according to the laws of the state of Florida and the federal government. But we sent it only about 4 or 5 times a year. And this year was a little bit less because of my poor health. But we're coming back a little bit and we're trying to get back onto the exercise bike and get those newsletters out to you. A lot of you follow us on Facebook, and we are so happy to have that. We're so happy to see you follow us and like us and friend us on Facebook. Again, unfortunately, I had planned to really be there more frequently, but it's very difficult without having a laptop right now and having to go from the bedroom where I spend, unfortunately, too much of my time because I have to rest and coming into the office to do the work here. But that's okay. The fact is that we're thrilled to have you here. We're going to try to be back on Facebook as quickly and as often as we can. Now, a lot of you who listen to the audio versions of a podcast, you don't go to YouTube, just want to listen to the audio, and that's great. We're thrilled to have you. We're on all the major podcast platforms and even some that we never even heard of before, but we're there. However, most of those big name platforms provide you with the opportunity of leaving a rating of either in stars or a couple of sentences regarding the podcast, podcast host, etc. And that's very important to not only to us here at Five Alarm Task Force, but to all podcasters, because the fact that the platforms use that data in their algorithms for how you'll turn up in a search. So if you're looking for Bill's website or Bill's podcast, and you have no idea where anything is, and he's not received any positive comments or star ratings, Bill's podcast is going to be way down low in the results. Well, we don't want that to happen to Five Alarm Task Force or any of our brothers and sisters or buffs who like to listen to us. We want you to be able to find us quickly if you're looking. And so the best way to do that is just take a moment. You only have to do it once. You don't have to do it every podcast. Just leave a couple of stars for us or a couple of sentences about how you feel about the podcast. Hopefully you're in favor. If you have constructive criticism, please provide that as well. We have to learn to grow to bring you the type of programming you want us to provide to you. And that's it. That's all our business for today. And we'll be back right after these words with our guest, Captain E.J. Henninger, right after these words. As always, please stay tuned. New technology for the fire service seems to appear almost every day. And that technology demands a learning curve, especially if we're talking about thermal imaging cameras. That's where Insight Fire Training LLC is your best bet. With an excellent reputation across the U.S., Insight Fire Training will meet all your TIC training needs. Their curriculum is peer-reviewed and has been used internationally. Their instructors are Level 1 Thermography Certified, and they have taught in 33 states and 4 countries. Their courses run from introductory to training the trainers. Courses are available online, for the classroom, classroom hybrid, and even live fire. Insight Training LLC is proficient in over 40 thermal imaging cameras, so you feel confident they will know your make and model. Best of all, programs are customized to your specific needs, and their cadre of fire service veterans are vetted craftsmen of Project Kill the Flashover. They are so proficient that they have trained TIC manufacturers on how to best use and sell their own product. That's Insight Fire Training LLC. Look them up on InsightTrainingLLC.com, your best bet for TIC training. Would you like to meet up with Andy and the team from Insight Training LLC? Well, here's part of their upcoming schedule. On December 12th, Insight Training will be providing a 4-hour live fire thermal imaging training and demonstration with a Max Firebox at Hemby Bridge Volunteer Fire Department. That is in Indian Trail, North Carolina. On the 14th of December, Insight Training will provide a 3-hour custom webinar designed for Bentonville Fire Department in Arkansas on Introduction to Tactical Thermal Imaging. The event will be held online, again, on the 14th of December. On December 16th and 17th, Insight Training will provide a 2-day live fire training event custom-built for Stallings Fire Department in North Carolina for their FLIR K55 thermal imaging cameras. The training event will be provided in the following format. Friday evening, a 2.5-hour classroom session, followed by 2-hour live fire orientation burn. Saturday, all-day live thermal imaging training. Participants will participate in the following objectives: Tactical 360, Enhanced Stream Placement, Enhanced Search Methodology. And finally, on the 19th of December, Insight Training will be providing a custom webinar for Prince Albert Fire Department in Canada on the 19th at 18:30 hours local time on their FLIR KXX thermal imaging cameras. Seek Fire Pro X and the Scott Site MMTIC. Remember, please be sure to check their website, InsightTrainingLLC.com, or their Facebook page for registration and additional details. Insight Fire Training LLC, your best bet for fire service TIC training. The Firehouse Tribune, where inspiration was forged by those who came before us, opening the doors for us to build a path to share our mission with the rest of the emergency service world. With a small, tight-knit team of first responders dedicated to sharing experiences and knowledge, we constantly strive to provide our followers with thought-provoking content from all aspects of emergency services and life. Our contributors speak at top fire and EMS conferences in the country. They have been guests on numerous fire service podcasts and will even come and speak at your firehouse or event. Interested? Visit their website, www.thefirehousetribune.com, and find them on Facebook using the Firehouse Tribune, and on Twitter at FH Tribune, and on Instagram, FH Tribune. We live by one motto, not just in emergency services, but in life as well. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. We look forward to hearing from you soon. Until next time, work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. We're firefighters. We're law enforcement. Like everyone else, we have our aches and pains, sometimes from the job and sometimes not. We realize there are risks with this job. However, sometimes something is wrong with us and we don't know it. Now what do we do? Well, LifeScan Wellness Centers are dedicated to saving America's heroes. For most fire and police organizations, LifeScan Wellness Centers will send one of their mobile teams to assess every member of your department with complete and complex physical exams and blood work. Using state-of-the-art medical equipment, LifeScan staff members provide a multi-procedural exam, including cardiac stress tests, basic lab results, and ultrasound exams. LifeScan wellness exams have saved the lives of dozens of firefighters and police officers across the country. They have found tumors, aortic bulges, lung problems, and more, many of which were asymptomatic. However, early detection allowed most of these colleagues to have their personal medical professionals mitigate the health issue that otherwise might have led to a darker time. For more information, please visit their website at lifescanwellness.com. Remember, LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. Hello and welcome to this episode of Five Alarm Task Force. If you're watching the video, if you're listening to the audio, well, you already heard the beginning of the show and our introduction. Glad to have you all with us, whether you're listening on the audio podcast or watching us on our video podcast version on our YouTube channel, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. And my guest today has been a friend for, this is our seventh season. He's been a friend since season two, when he and his wife, who I did know from Adam, started submitting my name to a podcast contest. And we kind of met that way. And EJ and I became good friends. And we almost kind of like know about our families, even though we've never met again. It's one of the wonders and the blessings of doing this podcast for so long and having so many great guests on, who many of whom have become close friends and we've never met. But you know what? Friendship doesn't take you to have to be in person. That's one thing I've learned from this blessing that I've received with all the friends from the podcast. So my guest today is a good friend, EJ Henninger. He is Captain EJ Henninger, by the way. He has been designing building systems for more than 20 years. He is currently a senior engineering operation manager for a plumbing and fire protection team, developing designs for commercial and industrial projects. He has also been a volunteer firefighter for more than 10 years. And as I mentioned, he is currently the captain at a rural fire and rescue company with an active role in their training program. EJ has worked with the International Association of Fire Chiefs and through his annual Firefighter Relay Challenge to actively support the fight against cancer. And I am happy to add, though it's not written here yet, he has recently presented at Firehouse Expo. And that's always a great feat for anybody who is and enjoys teaching as much as you and I do for the fire service. He is happily married to his beautiful wife of 25 years and has three wonderful sons who are growing faster than I think my daughters grew up. EJ, it's great to have you. EJ, by the way, I should mention, those of you who weren't able to join us, our webinar on big box building construction in the fire challenges and sprinkler systems, EJ was our speaker and presented at that webinar because he comes with such a great pedigree. Not only has he been working in sprinkler engineering for more than 20 years, but he is a captain. He's a volunteer firefighter and the captain at his department. So EJ, my friend, it is a pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Finally.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here, Steve. Very humbled and truly thankful to finally be able to put this together and, you know, do it with someone, as you said, you know, is a friend. You know, it means a lot. Although I do have to say that introduction, I don't know. I feel like the bar's kind of set high.
Well, I think it's okay. I guess one of the things I've learned from those guests who have become friends, and even people from online who haven't been on guests on the show, but are very supportive of the podcast, is that the friendship, you know, it's not qualified. I found that, you know, we have this concept that we are brothers and sisters in a family, and a family that is dedicated to giving of ourselves to our communities, whether we're career, part pay, volunteer, WUI, part pay, whatever it is, it makes no difference. We're all part of the same amazing family. Probably, I'm not quite sure if we're up to 1.2, still a little bit, because we've had, you know, a lot of attrition, unfortunately, in the field, both in career and volunteer markets. But I think it's still a special relationship that we all have. And I think sometimes, even if we're not close to each other in distance through Zoom and through podcasts and through social media, that we are closer. And we try to keep that bond alive whenever we can. So today what we're going to do is we're going to talk with EJ about his fight career, what got him started as a volunteer, working his way up to the captain, and working with training. And then in the second part of the show, we're going to talk how those two, his avocation and his vocation, happen to fit together a lot better than any of mine did when I was a volunteer, because mine were like oil and water. The people in my vocation didn't like me being a volunteer in my avocation, but I kept the good fight up and I stayed a volunteer through both those jobs, because that was actually more important to me, to be able to serve the community, because I knew that neither of my employees had any ground to stand on that says they control my personal time 24/7. You know, when I'm not in that office, as long as I'm doing my job, I got to do what I want to do in my own time. That would be like telling me I couldn't take my wife and kids to the movies in case they needed me. So we'll take a pass on that. So what brought you to, I know it's probably, they are connected from the beginning, but what brought you to become a volunteer in your community?
Well, I mean, if we go all the way back, you know, I'm a product of the 70s, you know, everybody knows Emergency. Everybody loved Emergency. You know, my neighbor Tony and I, you know, would play Emergency, and, you know, we were John and Rory running around saving the neighborhood. So, you know, kind of had it back then, never really acted on it when I got older. Growing up, one of my good friends, his whole family ran with the local fire department. And it was to the point, you know, I'd sleep over at their house. You know, I could sleep through the scanner going off all night. But if, you know, his dad's company's tones dropped, I woke up too. You know, it got to that. But never joined. I don't know why. Probably just too young and ambivalent to it. And then later on in life, I started looking at it and thinking about it, and was too young and dumb and do it, because I didn't want to give up, you know, 2 months worth of full weekends to go through the academy. And then we ended up, Amy and I bought a house and we moved, and I didn't really want to run with the local department there. I would have rather run with the department I knew. Didn't think that was viable. So again, just kind of let it go. And then when we bought a house and moved, and our oldest son, Joey, was going from Cub Scouts to Boy Scouts. And, you know, when you come into Boy Scouts, you know, you have to earn service hours. And we were trying to figure out what he could do to get service hours. And Amy worked with a lady whose husband was very active in the fire service. And she suggested that we reach out to the fire company, you know, to see if he can go up there and do things. So we emailed the fire company asking about it, got a response. You know, the chief wants to meet with you and your son. Okay. So we go up to meet with the chief, and he says, well, where do you live? And I said, oh, you know, right down here. Oh, he's like, you're in the township. Somebody get this guy an application. I'm like, oh, hold on. You know, so we explained what we were there for. They thought he was there for more of a project. And we were like, no, we're just wondering, you know, can he, you know, help wash trucks, clean tools, you know, sweep floors, whatever. And they said, you know what, just, we're here, drill. We drill every Thursday night. Come up, hang out. You know, if you want to just watch us, he can. If you want to be, you know, do some stuff, if he can get his hours, that's great. But like I said, they were expecting him to be asking about a project, which he wasn't looking for, but we did anyway, which we ended up building flag retirement collection boxes for the township. And we started going up and hanging out on Thursday nights and watching what they were doing. And it didn't take long, and the bug bit me, and it bit me hard. You know, so I couldn't stay away. So, you know, instead of doing it when I was young and had all the free time in the world, ended up going through the academy in my mid 30s, you know, married with three kids and a full-time job. And luckily I have a family that was supportive enough. They're the ones that really made the sacrifices for me to be able to get it done and go through it. And that's how I got into the company I'm into right now.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the magic word, which is the show emergency, and we've brought it up on the podcast before, but I think, you know, we've never really addressed the listeners and the viewers. So I'm going to ask a little favor, folks. If now I was I was influenced by Emergency, but I was already in college when Emergency came out, and I love the show, watched it when I was home, because I only lived 20 minutes from school, but I lived on campus. But whenever I was home, I go into my parents' room, a little black, they only had a little black and white TV in there, and the big color TV was out in the den. But I would watch it. And even though I didn't plan on being a firefighter, I admired firefighters since I was 7 years old, saw my first one. And then when I walked into that station at my first real full-time job in just outside of Greensboro, North Carolina, and I just went in to look at the apparatus. And next thing I know, I walked out with an application. So if you are a listener to our podcast or you're watching the video, and the TV show Emergency was one way or another influential in bringing you to the fire service, whether as a volunteer, again, career, pay, we don't care. But if the show was influential to you, and you know, they just celebrated their 50th anniversary. Yep. They just had a special on, I think it was Cozy TV. I think it was Cozy TV that runs their shows 3 hours in the morning now. But they did a great retro and a 50th anniversary special for them. Would you please tag us on Twitter with the hashtag Emergency or Johnny and Roy on Twitter? You know, we're both on Twitter and Instagram. We're at the number 5 Alarm Task Force, all in one smushed up word, 5 Alarm Task Force. And let us know, you know, we would like to be able to show and talk about some numbers of how many of us, from an old fart like me at over 70 to somebody younger like EJ, and even rookies in first and second year people we've already heard about, who heard about that show and watched the reruns, whatever. So let us know, because we really like to talk about that here on the podcast, and just let everybody know what an important factor that was in many of us making this decision about becoming firefighters or paramedics. So it became really a family effort on your part, as it did with ours. I had our first daughter was born when I had first joined. Second daughter was born. I was working in the first job I was at. I was working 60 hours a week, 7 days a week, and doing the volunteer. And then in the job upstate New York, I was working 80 hours a week, 7 days a week also, and putting in as much time as I could, still making the top 10 runs on both departments. So, wow. Yeah. So, but when you came in, so let's ask this. You had already been working as a sprinkler design engineer, mm-hmm. when you came in to the fire department. Did number one, let's say, ask the about the elephant in the room. Did you tell the chief or the training officer that you had this this experience and this background?
Yeah, I think I did, because our chief at the time was also our local fire marshal. So I know, I remember specifically one time talking to him, because we had an issue going on with something at work, and you know, I wanted his viewpoint as a fire marshal. You know, what he would think if he saw that come across his desk for review. So yeah, they're aware of it. I mean, I don't know that anybody really really connect the dots or, you know, or realized the resource that it was, including myself. You know, for me, it was just more of a challenge to connect the dots. And it still is today. And it's kind of what keeps me going because, you know, at work, like I said, the position I'm at now, we do a lot of large commercial, industrial type stuff. I've worked where we were concentrating on high rise, pharmaceutical, healthcare. But I'm in rural Southeast Pennsylvania. You know, 85% of our township doesn't even have hydrants. You know, I remember being at the academy one time. One of the instructors said, "Oh, you guys just got a ladder truck, didn't you?" And I said, "No." And he says, "Oh, yeah, right. Biggest thing you guys have is barns. What would you need a ladder truck for?" So, you know, constantly trying to reconcile these two different worlds that I work and play in has always been, you know, half the fun of this. And it took a while till I realized the value and started trying to just share info, you know?
Yeah. Have you, how far are you out of this away from Philadelphia where you are?
Mileage wise, I guess.
No, I mean, time wise.
No, time wise, depending on like on a Sunday morning with little traffic, maybe 45 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, that's what my estimate was from being there so often in Philly, in the good old days.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID. Yeah. So did you, let me ask you this, with your professional knowledge, first of all, do you still have any sort of an aerial? Do you, or you're not at your department?
No, we have them all around us. You know, depending on the call, they're automatically dispatched.
Right,
but
right, for mutual aid.
Yeah. And
do you have a tanker? You guys run?
Yes.
Okay.
We have the largest tanker in our county.
Oh, wow.
We were known for it back in the day. We had a pair of tractor drawn tankers. Whoa. They were either 4,000 and 6,000 or 6,000 and 8,000 gallons. Yeah, both Mack tractors. They called us Mack Attack. They had a logo for it. Like we were, yeah, that was our thing. That was our thing. It was, I never got to see them in person, just the pictures, and I've heard the war stories. And
oh, right.
Yeah, pretty cool.
But now today you have a good sized tanker, in the largest one you said in the.
Yeah,
in the
we're 3,500 gallons on our tanker. So, and I like to think we're pretty proficient at tanker ops.
That's great.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a mix in North Carolina. It was a mix of some regular hydrants and dry hydrants that our chief was very big on installing. So in my 4 years, we put in a bunch of those, and it can be warm in Greensboro, North Carolina, the Greensboro area during the spring and summer to dig those and put them in creeks, small ponds, you know.
Yep.
So it was a challenge because we were mixed areas, some rural. We had a District 1, which was Station 17, where I was. We had a real big mix. We had some really large industrial stuff. We had a Fruhoff Depot, two major calls there in those 4 years, two major explosions, tanker explosions in those. So there's always the challenge. And while auto aid, which I think is still a great way to do it, because auto compacts really just take you away from the egos, and you know that if you need help on a call, the mutual aid departments are going to be there. It's not going to be, well, I don't like that deputy chief over that department, so I'm not going to go over there. I don't want them to come over here. We got to get beyond that in this day and age.
We do, and you still see it, and you hear some complaints. I think, you know, about, you know, we call it the buddy box up here. People claim it still exists. I don't believe it exists with us. You know, we did a concerted effort looking at our box calls and our mutual aid system and made it make logic, not friendship. County has been working through a concerted effort the last few years to help provide, they're doing data mining to help revise those boxes so that, you know, you will get the station that is, you know, legitimately the closest station, you know, as mutual aid. I don't know if it's still up to the company that submits the box on the final decision, but, you know, at least at this point, they're putting the info together so everybody can understand what's their best bet to get the best resource fastest. Right. And trying to eliminate that whole, you know, buddy box system.
Right, right.
There's no room for that.
Yeah, as with Nick Peppard and Sean Duffy, their podcast Make Do, that was all based, which they started here on Five Alarm Task Force, and now has become very successful, thankfully, because I'm just so proud of those two guys for deciding to give it a shot and being as successful as they are with it. That sometimes, you know, you don't have that. You don't have those agreements. And sometimes you wind up having to make do with what you have, because most of us don't live in communities that you can have three stations turning out for a reported house fire. Sometimes it's one station with three people on that engine, sometimes only two. Doesn't mean you can't respond. It means you got to show up and do what you can do with what you have.
Yep.
And that's, you know, a big lesson that unfortunately we're learning across the country today, both in career and volunteer departments, because of the shortages that we see. All right. So the fact is that no matter what we do in this field, it's going to be challenging. But the fact that you come with this extra, I don't know, first aid backpack on your shoulders, that you have the knowledge and the wisdom and the education of knowing and helping to design what will best suit a most commercial building of one kind or another, into reducing its fire risk by designing sprinkler systems for them. And this is one of the things that we push at this webinar, and that's why I invited EJ to be a speaker there. And that's because we wanted, you know, a lot of us respond on calls to buildings with sprinklers, but that doesn't mean we've necessarily learned how that system works and what our obligations are to do, what we have to do. Because a lot of people think, oh, it's automatic, so all the heads will go off and the fire will go out. You know, you've watched too many TV shows and Hollywood movies that somebody holds up a cigarette lighter to one sprinkler head and the whole building goes off. Right. That's not the way it works, folks. And until you've been in a drill in a sprinkler building that didn't have carpets and furniture yet, but was just a test of the system, and you got to light off one of those sprinkler heads, you learn quickly that, yeah, you get a lot of water. It was 30, 35 gallons per minute off that head that you're underneath. But if you look about 6 feet away, 8 feet away, there's no water other than what's trickling from your head on the floor. And so we take it for granted all too often. And I know in my days we did. We took it for granted that a sprinkler system would just knock out the fire, and then all we'd do is mop up and overhaul when we got there. But that's not the case, is it?
No, it's not. And that's, you know, why I kind of started this whole mission, you know, just to educate. You know, I'm far from being an expert. You know, I just happen to be in a unique situation where I have a vantage point that not a lot of people have. So I can look at this from two different perspectives. Like I said, the worlds don't align. But that just makes me think and dig and question more. You know, I know we did a pre-plan one time with another department, and I remember walking around the outside of the building and said, oh, hey, the building's got a fire pump. And somebody said, nah, it doesn't. And I'm like, yeah, I think it does. And they're like, pretty sure it doesn't. And I'm like, well, I'd be willing to bet my paycheck that's a pump test header on the wall. So we got the door open and went in, and, you know, there was a fire pump there. And, you know, I'm not faulting anybody. you know, if you don't know those systems and they're rare in our area, you know, you're not going to recognize them. It's a newer building you haven't been into. You know, you don't know it exists unless somebody tells you, you go find it. So, you know, like I said, that's why I push this, you know, education. And like I said, I have a vantage point where I think I can see where common things get missed or there's misconceptions that I can try and dispel.
Right. Well, I think that's very important. And I think that's why it was so valuable that the firehouse crew, when you submitted your presentation, I think they realized that you were unique and that, you know, they could have had a professional sprinkler designer talk, and they could have had a firefighter talk. But, how many people actually come equipped with knowledge on both sides?
Right.
And I think that's what's unique.
And in that one, I talked a lot about building systems. So, you know, HVAC, electrical, plumbing, green construction, things of that nature. And, you know, talking with Peter Matthews, you know, one of the reasons that it made it attractive to him was, and we've heard about this, you know, the younger generation coming into the fire service, they don't, that skill base of being working with your hands and using tools and having basic carpentry, construction, home repair knowledge is going away.
Right.
Which I hadn't really thought of or considered. And it's, I believe it's true and it makes sense. So, you know, Pete saw the opportunity to kind of open that door, as the next generation isn't really learning about these things as they're growing up, is a way to introduce them to this knowledge base.
Yeah. I came in also very raw as far, I had no background or, you know, in the fire service. I could use basic hand tools, hammers, hand drills in those days, screwdrivers, pliers, because I was into electronics, a solder gun. I could use that, but I came in with no background for the fire service. And I was very lucky that, number one, our department training was excellent for a volunteer department with two stations. But more importantly, my buddy and I, he was a kid back then. He was 18. I was 25. We were both voted in the same night. And we had a great mentor, one of the caretakers. We had three caretakers, 24 on, 48 off. Their job was to get the first apparatus out, whether it was day or night.
Right.
But one of them became a really great mentor to Rich and I. And I learned stuff. Even he taught me how to change the spark plugs in my car in those days, how to set the timing in my car. And I had no idea because I always took my car right down around the corner from the house to the gas station. My dad said, fill it up and leave it with George. I'll pay for it when I fill up this week. So I didn't come with any of that kind of hand skill knowledge other than, you know, I could handle hand tools and soldering gun pretty well. But I was thrilled with the background that this officer who is 2 years older than I am, that he came into. He was an Air Force firefighter as well, and then came. And then even when the city of Greensboro bought out the area that we used to be in, I was long gone already, but they annexed that. It turned out that they took over the tank farm. That was right across from the airport that was in our district. And that was the second largest finished product gasoline tank farm in the nation at that time. Yeah. And we had no major fires in the 4 years I was there and even the 4 years not, but it wasn't, I think it was in the early 2000s, they had one of the tanks was struck by lightning, but they had put a new station out there and they had invested in a super gun. And they knocked that out with a triple F through that gun in about 2.5 hours, I think it was, or a little bit less than that. So we know that investment, even our chief was very involved doing subsurface applicators in those days. And we had a lot of a triple F in our department. Luckily, I didn't get any splashed on me during those 4 years because the chief was flammable liquid specialist. All right, so I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, let's talk about the evolution of how you, your concept, how you put it, start with a drawing. How do you start with a plan of setting up a sprinkler system? And the, some of the imperatives that our listeners who are firefighters should pay attention to and really should have a kind of like a working knowledge on. We'll do that in the, kind of like in the summary, because not everybody can have all the same background, all the same training. But it, again, like you said, where, depending on where you live in your area, 85%, you don't even have hydrants. But we have people who need to know how sprinkler system, basically how a sprinkler system works and what they should know if they're arriving on a first new engine or they're in the second new that's supposed to make the hookup to the standpipe. So we're going to take a quick break, folks. If you're watching the video, you're not going to see anything change or anything different. If you're listening to the audio, well, you know what happens. We're going to pause here for a couple of messages, and we're going to be right back with my guest, Captain E.J. Henninger, right after these words. As always, please stay tuned. The tone sound and the dispatcher announces, stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. And that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the Red Cross lay, and head for the open front door, where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. Crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything. What the hell are you thinking? You see, it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go to. Face peace on.
The physical and mental demands of a firefighter place major stress on our minds and body, and especially our heart. Far too many of our brothers and sisters in the fire and emergency service are lost each year due to cardiac arrest. In fact, statistics show that those of us active in this profession are much more susceptible to cardiac arrest than the general population. Too often, ignoring the warning signs is a fatal decision. Your body will definitely be signaling to you that something is wrong, a feeling that you have never had before. If you don't feel well, don't make it your farewell. Seek medical attention immediately. If someone under your command or in your unit is not feeling well, don't send them home. Don't send them to the bunk hall. Insist they get checked immediately. Let's change the culture in our profession, in our departments, of ignoring the warning signs our bodies are telling us. Visit IAFC.org to learn how.
This message is brought to you by the International Association of Fire Chiefs and this podcaster.
It just slows me down.
It's too hard to do it and put my gear on.
I'm not comfortable.
I'm a big guy. I can't do it.
I'm just not comfortable wearing it.
You gotta be kidding me. Real firefighters don't need them.
Come on. There's no way I can wear my SCBA and my seatbelt at the same time.
Yes, we've heard all the excuses, but we can think of at least one good reason why you should buckle up. Can't you? Be a hero to those who mean the most to you. Buckle up. A message from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation.
Hi, this is Steve. It's hard to believe that we're just 1 week away from the Thanksgiving holiday and also leading us right into the major winter holidays of Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa. This time of the year is always special for a lot of people, for most people, I would say. But there are those who might not have such a easy time or being looking forward to the holiday season. While we can't help everybody all the time, there is a group that we can help, and we just need to make it our goal and an aim, and that is helping our brothers and sisters of the fire service in dire need. We are asking you, when you visit our website at www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. And if you scroll down on that homepage, you'll see the picture of the Federal Q siren. Okay, now if you don't know what a Federal Q siren is and you like to listen to our show, that's okay. The Federal Q siren is a big silver siren that sits usually on the bumper or right on the nose of many fire apparatus. And when you do that, our donation page will pop up. And we're not asking you to give us thousands upon thousands of dollars. We're asking you if maybe you could donate $5 or $10. And that donation page will, that single page, that's the only place you have to go to, that'll allow you to put in your, whether it's a credit card you want to use or an ACH transfer or a check that you want to mark in your book as being used. And that money, when you make a donation on that page, make sure you say for the foundation, because with our credit card processors, all the money goes into the operations account, then we transfer it over to the foundation. But as long as you notate that for us, that you made a donation and you put the word foundation on it, then, and that's part of the form, it's part of that donation form on our website. Not a problem. You don't have to think of anything else to do it. Just fill out that form. And that note will come to directly to our office. We'll know exactly who made the donation and the amount of it, and we'll know to make sure that we transfer it over at the end of any month to the foundation account. And, you know, this foundation was created not just by me, Steve Green, but along with my two wonderful friends and also both firefighters, and that's Battalion Chief Andy Starnes and Firefighter Nick Higgins of the Firehouse Tribune. And you probably know Andy's name if you're in the fire service because of Insight Training. He is one of the great teachers and instructors today on the use of thermal imaging cameras on the fire ground. But there are lots of our brothers and sisters who are too proud to ask for help. They're uncertain of the times. And we have the opportunity over the next 6 weeks and even into the first of 2023, we have the ability to help them out. And again, a lot of small donations are a big help. They really are. So don't feel that we're pinning you up against the wall to give us a major donation. We don't need a major donation. We want small donations. A lot of small donations are wonderful. And the fact is that it's not even the amount of money, but your brothers and sisters will be so grateful that you are out there supporting them, helping them when they're strangers. They don't know you, but we know something better. We are a family. The fire service is a family. Yeah, sometimes we argue and we fight. Well, that happens with almost any family, right? So that's the issue. Don't worry about it. We're here to take care of our brothers and sisters. So please take a moment, visit our website. It's on the, you can just go to our website and hit this, scroll down the page. You'll see this picture of the siren. Click on that and that little donation form will pick right up. To all of you, we wish you and yours a happy and safe and healthy Thanksgiving. Until next time, this is Steve, and this is My View. Hello, and welcome back to this episode of 5 Alarm Task Force. And my guest today is Captain E.J. Henninger with a small semi-rural department about an hour outside the city of Philadelphia. An area, same county though, Montgomery, still Montgomery County, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Montgomery, which I used to visit North Montgomery County frequently because we have family living right outside the city of Philadelphia, and we'd visit them frequently, especially during the summers and on vacation breaks. And in those days, I'd hit the bricks while my wife and sister-in-law went shopping, and I would visit volunteer firehouses and Philadelphia City firehouses as well. And Philadelphia Fire Department, just a great group of people, they've had great commissioners right now, Commissioner Adam Teal, just a terrific guy. He was a guest with several other chiefs on a program we did on the EFL program from the Academy. And so now with EJ, what we want to talk about is asking him to explain, because most of us don't know, and I don't know the roots of how a designer like him starts doing their process. How do they create, you know, they get, we're building a 3-story, 8,600 square foot professional office building. So where do you start? You put in bids or what, how does it work?
Yeah. So, you know, we'll get a request for a proposal, for an existing client or, you know, a new client. And they'll give it, you know, they'll propose a project that they want to build, a building that they want to build with some information. And we'll put together a proposal of, you know, what we envision the scope of work to be, how we plan to document the work and submit a fee. A lot of times we're competing against other engineering firms. So it's just like a contractor bidding a job. You know, you gotta know what you're talking about. You gotta explain that you know how to do it. You know, you have previous history doing the same type of work. And obviously you have to have a good price, you know, and if you're high or you think you're high, you have to explain why. I know my one company, we used to get some work. We were never, I shouldn't say never, we weren't always the lowest bidder on the job. But at that time, money was a little better. Their project managers could select their engineering firm. And they knew they were better off paying us more money for our design because we would have a tighter design package and they would have less issues in construction, which means less change orders. So through the overall life of the job, you ended up saving money because you spent more to have a quality design up front that avoided a lot of hiccups through the build process.
Sure. So do they submit to you the basic blueprints? Is that what they?
No, usually it's, there might be some, we call them block diagrams. So kind of like cartoony floor plans, you know, it just might have colored areas and it'll say, you know, this is laboratory, this is office, this is mechanical, just so we kind of have a feel for the overall square footage. And they'll describe the operations and the uses of the spaces. But that's pretty much it. You know, we have to kind of fill the dots in based on experience and try and understand. Sometimes, you know, we might have some existing documentation that we can review. You know, if we're doing a renovation, you know, they might provide drawings. But the initial process is usually pretty, pretty vague.
Okay.
And then, you know, if we win the job, that's when it starts getting more interesting and then the rubber hits the road, so to speak.
So are you looking at fire load? Is that one of the factors that you have to continue? Because I mean, let's say professional office, you could have 6, 8, 10 standard business offices. Then there's a dentist going in who's putting in, you know, several different types of gases in there, oxygen, putting in nitrogen, you know, so that's going to be different than, you know, the standard business office, three doors down.
Yeah. I mean, we're fortunate enough in our business that we have a pretty good idea of what's going to be going in there. You know, we're working with clients that have a business model specific, task or operation that they're going to do in these spaces. So we do have a good understanding up front, but, you know, I have also worked where we did, you know, like spec built, we call them core and shell buildings. You know, you get the shell of the building and a core with like the elevators and the stairs and toilet rooms. And then, you know, they lease it out and do tenant fit outs. And, you know, you're kind of rolling the dice there, because if you go into it thinking, okay, this is going to be an office building and you design for, you know, a specific hazard, which I don't necessarily agree with it, but, you know, office buildings are, you know, the lowest, it's literally called light hazard in NFPA, which, you know, if you look at an office, you look at the combustible loading with all the papers and plastics and computers and electronics and synthetic furnishings, it's kind of doesn't really make sense that that is considered the latest hazard. But that's how it is. So yeah, if they ended up finding a dentist that wanted to go in there and do a tenant fit out, and you're looking at it, an increased hazard occupancy, then, you know, you might not have the water supply, you know, your design might be blown out of the water. So it's a roll of the dice in those. I've been there, done that. Sometimes you try and over-engineer it if you can. But then you also have to have an owner that's willing to pay for it.
Right.
They're not going to want to pay for something that they're not going to get use out of later. But on the other hand, if they're leasing it out, they can make that money back with the monthly rent. So.
Right. Right. All right. So you're at this point now, you're starting to do the drawings. How do you, I guess you have standards you meet that will tell you, let you know that you're meeting a potential fire load for mm-hmm. the building.
Yep.
Right. And so you fill them all out, and then you provide the initial details to your client, let them get their fingers wet with the ink and see what you're talking about, and if that's what they're looking for, and things like that. How much time would you generally estimate from receiving the set of plans that you're going to work from to your first, you know, drawings to work with them?
I mean, hour wise, it's hard to say because, you know, that'll vary on the project. As far as like a percentage of fee, I would say that we probably spend 50 to 60% of our budget to get to what I would say is a 30% level of documentation. Right. Because that's going to include all the upfront thinking that you don't see on paper. And this process starts out with programming. So, okay, we have a floor. Okay, what are you putting in the floor? Like I said, we had the block diagrams. Like, okay, we have this big block, and this color is going to be office, and this color is going to be labs. Okay, well, what kind of labs do you have? You know, is it a school lab? Is it a pharmaceutical lab? Are there flammables? Are there biologics? You know, so you start doing this data mining and programming, and you really bore down to how the spaces are going to work and what the hazards are going to be in each individual space. Now, for me, on the fire protection side, once we take that and we have that knowledge, now we go back to codes, NFPA. We deal a lot with, because our clients don't deal with your run-of-the-mill things and have very specific, very expensive equipment and uses. And like in the pharmaceutical world, you're talking about things that people are putting in their bodies. Their insurance companies are very involved and have very detailed design requirements. And the clients have their own design requirements too. But the insurance companies, you know, they're above and beyond code. They're very detailed and they're very important because, you know, violating the insurance company standards, while they're not a code enforced, you know, mandate, it's still required. Now the client doesn't have to follow it, but then they risk paying a higher premium or, you know, having something excluded from a protection excluded from their policy. So a lot of research that goes into, like I said, researching client standards, insurance carrier standards, all the NFPA codes. So from there, then we decide, okay, what is our hazard class? Basically, you know, how big of a problem do we have and how much water are we going to need? Now we jump to the outside of the building. Okay, do we have water? You know, how much water do we need? And then it starts from a progression from the outside through the space. So getting water to the building. Once it's in the building, do we have pressure? You know, are we looking at a fire pump? Do all that analysis. The company I'm at now, we do a lot of hydraulic calculations. So we will actually do some basic 3D modeling up front and run hydraulic calculations to prove out our water needs. Once we get that worked out, we get water in the building, we know we can cover our hazards. Then we start looking at individual spaces, you know, can it be wet system? Does it have to be dry? Do we need any clean agent suppression because we have sensitive electronics or things that don't do good in water, things of that nature. So we start boring down into specific applications so the systems match the hazard and the need.
Right, right. All right, so I think this gives our listeners and viewers an insight into the kind of work that you and those of you, those others who are like you designing these systems, the vast majority of us take them for granted. We walk into a store or an office going to the doctor and we see the sprinkler heads there and I'm a firefighter. I know what those are, but you know, we don't know a lot about them. And I think, and the concept of the sprinklers, and I think this gives our listeners and viewers that basic idea is that, you know, there's a lot of thinking, planning, designing, redesigning, redesigning, and redesigning, depend on the client and the government entities that you're dealing with, from whether it's a small village or a big city or the county or even the state, that there are always going to be challenges that as system designers, you need the information for, you start making your plans, and then you need their feedback on those plans so that you can fine tune them for that. And I think that's great, because I don't think we didn't even bring that up at the webinar. And I think it's great background for other firefighters to have. But again, because most of us are not in urban settings, we're in suburban settings. Mm-hmm. And with suburban, we have a lot of mixed use in many communities. And even though you're 85% off of hydrant, you probably still have some mixed use though in the district. Mm-hmm. So no matter what it is, folks, we have to be prepared for those usage. That's the key. All right. So let's then round it up with new firefighter, just joined the department, going through, got fireman, you know, 1 and 2, maybe has done some other work, but hasn't done hydraulics yet. Hasn't got taken a hydraulics and pump panel course. All right. So what is the average firefighter? If they arrive on the scene of a building with a sprinkler, and again, hopefully your alarm service or your dispatch service through the alarm service in those buildings will let you know if it's a activated sprinkler or if it's a silent fire alarm going off or something like that, so you have an idea. So if the department knows that there are sprinklers in a given building, what should the firefighters on those first two apparatus that are due there, what should they be looking for, the firefighters on there? Not, and I don't mean just the driver or the officer. What should they be looking for in a sprinkler building or structure?
Well, I guess, like you said, you know, if they were dispatched for an alarm, what type of alarm is it? You know, is it, do you have a detector, you know, some type of smoke detector that popped, or do you have a water flow alarm? You know, obviously water flow alarm, I don't want to discredit, you know, a detector alarm. We've been talking about in our station about, you know, getting complacent. You hear guys talk about it a lot, you know. You know, there's a mall in our county, and I had a buddy that ran in one of the local fire companies, and I forget the number of alarm calls that they go to at that mall. It was staggering, you know, and the percentage of legitimate alarm activations was minuscule. So, you know, it's easy to get complacent, but you can't. So I don't want to discredit or minimize, you know, responding to an alarm for a detector. But obviously if you have a water flow alarm, you know, something's going on, you got water right. move. So, you know, is it a sprinkler that activated from heat? Is it a sprinkler that got knocked off Somebody walking with a ladder and wasn't paying attention. You could have just had a pressure surge outside in the street that came in the building and was enough to move that vein in the pipe and trigger that alarm. So the first step would be understanding what type of alarm you have. And I guess beyond that, it's just kind of having a general understanding of what type of system it is and why is it there? You know, what are you protecting? You know, is it, you said, is it an office building with what could be kind of like a, consider a minimal threat? You know, is it a Big Lots that has a bunch of furniture stored in the back? Or the example you use, you know, is a dentist office where you're going to have, you might have some medical gases stored in high pressure cylinders. So, you know, it's understanding the hazards that are there that required the sprinkler system.
Okay.
So that's what's going to bite you, the hazard.
All right. So let's take it to another level then. Let's say the dispatch is for working fire. They've got multiple calls on it. It is a sprinkler building. You know that not you, your district, specifically your district, but you're a firefighter and you know it's in your district. You're going to be responding to this. You get toned out. You make the first due engine or the second due apparatus, what's a truck or an engine, whatever, or pump or a tanker, whatever's coming out second due. And what should you know it's a sprinkler building from your pre-plan in notebook in the cab. What is that officer or what are they going to want to do when they first arrive there on a sprinkler building? Water flow is going and we know we have multiple calls on a working fire.
It's kind of tough. Like I said, even though I designed this stuff as far as working as a firefighter, like I said, we're so limited on the sprinkler systems. You know, we don't operate very often with right. them. So, and everybody's got, you know, their different SOPs, SOGs and tactics. You know, I can just say from my vantage point, you know, and this would be any fire, establishing water supply is number one,
right?
You know, grab a hydrant, lay in, you know, you want to find you need to know where your fire department connection is. You want to get hooked up if you have to, supplement the water supply or be able to control that water supply. So yeah, establish water, find your fire department connection, get hooked up, get ready to feed the building. Knowing where your service entrance is and being able to, you know, where your isolation valves are, you know, maybe your policy is, you know, once you get in and you get on it and you see, okay, the sprinklers got it knocked, everything's controlled. You know, maybe your policy is to shut the system down so you can prevent less damage. And then, you know, you operate off of hand lines to do mop up or something like that. So I don't know if there's an overall, you know, standard tactic to deal with it. But, you know, I guess kind of the cop-out answer is whatever your company says, you know your SOPs, know your SOGs. But like I said, any fire, your water supply is going to be key. Getting on that and getting that established so you can do what you need to do.
All right. So you mentioned fire department connection, which is something in FDC, something that you and I talked about before the webinar, because a lot of people, I was very surprised to find out, and you know, they're the younger firefighters don't really know what a fire department connection is, other than they think it's a hydrant.
Well, it kind of is. It's just going the other way.
Saying that, I have to say that when I was in that department in North Carolina, we had one guy, really nice guy, young guy, would do anything he would. He was a painter, but he was illiterate, unfortunately. Could barely read, but he would do any job on the fire on the fire department. And one day we were practicing our responses, where first due drops the hydrant package there, takes off, second due engine makes the connection and feeds one into it, feeds one, pushes one up to the first engine. So when it was his turn to take the package, he took the package off, wrapped it around the hydrant, sent the engine down. Then he took one end of the hose for the pipe, put it on one butt, and then turned it around, put it in the other butt, turned on the hydrant. He was flowing the water in the hydrant. So I think it's important that we just kind of clearly define for the listeners of yours, what is a fire department connection? What does it basically look like?
Well, again, that could vary, right? So depending on your municipality or the size of your system, it could be multiple 2.5-inch hose connections. It could be a single, you know, large diameter Storz connection on the wall. You know, and what it is used for, usually, say you'll have a pipe that comes in from the municipal water supply and feeds the sprinkler system. This will be piped in where, right where the water comes into the building. Your fire department connection will pipe in and connect to that. It's got a check valve, so it's unidirectional flow. You hook your truck up to it. If you would lose water pressure in the street, or for whatever reason, the municipal water supply isn't cutting it, you're hooked up. You're basically turning your truck into the municipal water supply, and you're going to pump water through your truck or out of your tank into the system. And like I said, either supplement flow or pressure in the sprinkler system itself. It also gives you the ability, if you want to shut down the municipal supply, and it gives you total control of water flow. So you could also use it for that situation too.
Right.
So it's really your controlled water supply to the building.
Okay. And let's tell them what a riser is, so they have an idea when they hear that term, and it's not somebody who gets up early in the morning.
So my definition of a riser is once a water supply comes in, you have a vertical section of pipe that's going to have some type of control valve. On wet systems, it's typically what we call an alarm check. You know, a dry system is called a dry pipe valve. There's other valves called pre-action valves, and usually you'll have one riser or riser valve per zone or hazard or type of system. So, I mean, it could come in and you have one riser with your control valve that serves the whole building, or you could have a horizontal pipe with a manifold with 8 risers with, you know, a combination of alarm checks, dry pipe valves, pre-action valves, and the whole gamut.
All right. So really then it's not as technical for the average firefighter, but they should have the basic knowledge if their buildings in their district have sprinkler systems in them. So mm-hmm. You should know that in advance, because that can change even your whole concept of response by knowing if you have something that's already there that will help put out the fire initially, and then you got to go in there and help it or mop up behind it, or you don't. And it's going to be all hands on deck for the safest way of putting out that that blaze, you know.
Yep.
And you know, and the reason why, folks, that we did this webinar specifically on this topic of big buildings, and that's because is that in the previous 15 months, I think it was, or 16 months, we had 3 major building fires, 1 Walmart and 2 Home Depots went up, and I think one of them, there was a problem because the sprinkler did not activate as it was supposed to. But you also have to remember that based on with everything that EJ shared with us, a lot it's going to depend on the contents of the building.
Absolutely.
And what the structure has. So you take a big box store like a Walmart that has all sorts of product in it, as does the home improvement stores as well. But you have everything from clothing, and a lot of clothing today is fireproof, to you go to the the grill and barbecue section where they have tanks, propane tanks out there. They have charcoal out there. They have lots of plastic out there. And so an initial dump, even at, you know, 35, 40 gallons a minute from a head may not, you know, be enough depending on how many heads there are to do that out. So if you need to still have the knowledge of the basic contents of the commercial structures in your district, a basic knowledge.
Yeah. And you know what? You need to have somebody that's staying knowledgeable with what's changing.
Right.
We've had the conversation on some of these big fires, you know, and inevitably pretty high up in the comments or pretty quick in the comments you hear, while, you know, the sprinklers didn't keep up, the sprinklers weren't there, you know, they can't keep up with combustibles today. And as an engineer, I'm like, no, like, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, it is impossible that something could be misengineered or underengineered, but you know, it's really hard for me to see. There's so many checks and balances in this process between the, you know, the multiple reviews that we go through internally, and then it's reviewed by our clients, and then it's reviewed by their insurance carriers, and then it's reviewed by, you know, the local authority to give, you know, that sign off on the construction drawings. And then no sprinkler contractor builds off of my drawings at all, period. The sprinkler contractor then generates their own drawings that are based on my design that are built from. So then when they do that, then their stuff has to go to the AHJ, their stuff has to go to the insurance carrier, and then their stuff comes back through me for my review. So there's so many checks and balances it goes through. And, you know, life safety systems are not engineered, you know, to just, you know, oh, we need to, we'll just barely get it. You know, it's overdone. And, you know, and I know, like I said, we deal with a lot of insurance companies, and I can tell you, that things are over engineered because they can't take that loss in business continuity. They can't take that, you know, loss of product. And it's not to say that they don't care about life safety, but by going overboard to protect the contents, you know, the life safety aspect is taken care of, you know,
yeah, sure,
how many times over. So I've been thinking a lot, and I know I've shared some thoughts with you recently about this whole process and where things go wrong. And, you know, and I wonder if, like we talked about earlier, the core and shell office building that ended up with a dentist office, you know, that building get designed for a late hazard occupancy and somebody missed that. Oh, you know what? This should be an ordinary one or an ordinary two. You know, I'm not exactly sure, like how a Home Depot or Lowe's is laid out, but I'd be willing to bet that they're all done off of prototypes. You know that they have a prototypical layout that they do, right. And you know if those sprinkler areas are zoned, you know, I'm sure the zone that has all the paints is probably a higher hazard class than maybe somewhere else in the building. You know, did somebody think, oh, well, you know, let's change the layout. You know, let's move one hazard. Let's move a hazard from one zone to another. And, you know, are we not really covered to protect it? So not only recognizing and finding these hazards, but keeping up with them as they change or evolve is huge too. And somebody's got to have that knowledge base to be able to say, yeah, I don't know about that. I'm not, somebody's got to prove this out to me.
That's a good point. And I think what you mentioned about people say, well, there wasn't enough water. I think the fact of the matter is, folks, water will still put out a wood fire. But we don't have a lot of stuff that's still built from simple wood anymore. So that's what we have to bear in mind. It's not that there's not enough water to put out a wood fire. Water will always put out a wood, plain wood fire if it's real wood. From your simple campfire with sticks and branches to a house that was made out of wood and it's wood side, and all the furniture was made of real wood. And, you know, that's when in my day, when I was a firefighter, we had all real wood stuff. Our furniture was real wood. It wasn't, you know, a knockoff made from, benzene side products. The stuffing in a couch wasn't foam. It was kapok from a tree.
Right.
So, I mean, we could put those fires out. Yeah. We still, you know, a lot of smoke, a lot of fire, but we could put them out with regular hand lines, and we didn't need to use, you know, any, light water or anything like that. But today,
you know what, let me throw this scenario at you too. So you have, a warehouse, you have a client that's doing a product and they have all their stuff. All their product is in cardboard boxes and it's on wooden pallets, right? So, you know, obviously, you know, like you just said, you know, wood's not a formidable fire to extinguish.
Right.
You know, cardboard's going to soak up water. It's going to collapse. It's going to hold that water. Somebody comes along, I don't know, maybe somebody else decides to lease that warehouse space, or maybe somebody says, hey, you know what? We keep, you know, we're spending a lot of money on wooden pallets. Why is that? Well, they get damaged or they get ruined or whatever. So we get them out. Somebody says, you know what? We're going to switch to plastic pallets because maybe because they're cleanable or they get a longer lifespan out of them. And then somebody, for whatever reason, you know what? We want to stack a little higher. So to make sure these loads don't shift, we're going to start shrink wrapping everything in plastic. So you've gone from cardboard boxes on a wood pallet to a fire load that's encapsulated in plastic on a plastic pallet.
Right.
You know, did anybody catch that change? Is a fire inspector going to catch that if he hasn't been in that building in a year and somebody decided to change their business model? So I think it's things like that are happening that are causing these problems on these fires, but I don't know for sure. I'm just theorizing. I mean, obviously I'm going to defend the engineering world because I live in it. I don't like to think that we make mistakes, although we do. And I get it. I mean, nobody's perfect, but like I said, I'd like to think that, there's other issues. It's not just as plain and simple as, sprinklers can't put fires out anymore. From residential to commercial, I still think it's some of the best protection you get.
Absolutely. I wouldn't doubt you for a moment. And I think that, if you're going to be a firefighter who wants to hone his or her craft and not just say, I got the t-shirt, then this is something that you need to pay attention to in your department. You need to know. And, it's not a crime to ask a question.
No.
If you're going by, you see something in a building that happens to be in your district, not because you were on a call, you were just driving by or you were in the store, whatever the case was, and you have something that kind of like just sticking out at you, go back and ask your officer, go back and ask your chief or your fire inspector. Don't be afraid to ask the question because you just don't know where that question might be so important that nobody else, like you just talked about the example you gave about changing the pallets to plastic and wrapping it all with plastic wrap. That changes the whole aspect of what kind of results you're going to get from how that room was initially set up for sprinklers.
Yes.
It was set up with great protection. But now, because of the product, not the building, the product that's in that same room that was doing fine, now you have another threat and danger to it at all. So I think I'm glad we cleared that up and made that apparent to our viewers and listeners, because I think that's key. That's a key aspect for everyone to realize. No one's changing the, we changed the, what used to be the fire triangle, about 40 years ago, to the four-sided, because we have to remember that there's the chemical reaction, which, when I first learned, it was the chemical triangle. Then we added the fourth branch, which is the chemical reaction. And that's what, whereas the water will knock out the wood, simple wood or things like that, when you change the product, the what you're going to use to put out that fire might be changed as well. And you have to be aware of that by being up on your basic fire knowledge. And, whether you've already attained firefighter 1 and 2 and you're not looking to be an inspector per se, but ask questions, look into it, do something about, ask somebody else questions. And never be afraid to share something that you've seen that you're not sure about with an officer or one of the line chiefs or the chief of the department, if you need to go there, because listen, it's not just your life. It's every firefighter's life. It's the citizens around the building. There are a lot of people involved in this. And one thing that you spot just by chance might be the thing that saves a life or prevents a major fire next time around, because you happen to spot and say, I heard somebody talking on a webinar or on a podcast, or I was at a lecturer at at Fire Expo or at the FDIC, and if you learn something there, man, don't keep it to yourself. Share it. Share it with anybody. You know, whether it's a conference, local, regional, a podcast, and you know, and at the end of every one of our podcasts, we list a minimum of 12 other firefighting podcasts, most of which I try to listen to. I can't get them all done in a week because there's just too many, but I listen to as many as I can. And these are good ones. And I think that if you want to enhance your learning, basically for free, for the most part, listen to firefighting podcasts and stay with the ones that you feel have meaning for you. If it's, you know, if you like just talk around the bunk room, that's the one you should listen to. If you want to listen to specific tactics or something, topics like we discussed today about EJ's background, but his not only as a firefighter, but as a sprinkler design engineer, that's something else. So that's another piece you can bring to the puzzle to help solve it so that you and your department are on the cusp of what's happening in your district and that you and every firefighter in your department and those who might come in mutual aid will have the best knowledge that stuff is out there to protect them and they can do the best job they can. And that's what this job is all about, is making sure we do the best job we can, saving lives and property. And that first life has to be our own, or else we can't help anybody else.
Absolutely.
Right. Right. AJ, man, I can't thank you enough. This was great. I think the topic, and I'm glad we did it after the webinar. Okay. We're about 6 weeks after the webinar. I'm now talking with Nick and Andy about one for January. And by the way, sincere congratulations to our good friend, a member of the board, volunteer member of the board here at Fire Alarm Task Force Corp, Nick Higgins, and his beautiful wife who just had their first daughter born as the second child, their first daughter. They have a little boy.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So.
Oh, good for them. Good for them.
Happy to wish them, as we say in Greek, mazel tov. But no, that's not Greek, folks. That's actually Hebrew or Yiddish. Good luck to them. Mom and baby were doing fine when I got the notice the other day, and just so happy for them. Yeah, it's great news. And again, Nick, a great friend that I've never met. You know, him and Andy are like brothers from another mother. EJ, you're about that at that point too. You know, we just feel like family. And I'll tell you something else. There's nothing better than being a firefighter and knowing your family. That's the best part.
It's the only thing that kept me sane for the last few years, I can tell you that.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. So folks, that's going to be the end of this video. My sincere thanks to my friend, brother firefighter, a sprinkler system design engineer, Captain EJ Henninger, for sharing some time today in a busy day. It's still a work day for him. And sharing his knowledge of both sides of the coin that he services. You know, he has to polish both sides to make sure that, you know, everything is doing okay. We will be back with you the week after Thanksgiving. We're going to take next week off. And we hope and wish you all a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. Remember, we have to keep saying this. I hate that we have to say it. But when you see emergency lights, please move over. Even if you're a buff, and we love buffs because you guys are so supportive of the jobs that we all do. But be safe, okay? We're still losing too many brothers and sisters, first responders, firefighters, police, EMS, road rangers, recovery operators, because of distracted driving. And so please remember, especially the holiday season, holiday weekend, please drive carefully, know what you're doing, have your car ready for your trip if you're driving there, leave yourself plenty of time if you're flying, get to your airport early. You can always wait. You just don't want to miss that plane by showing up 2 minutes late. So just be careful. Have a great holiday, everyone. We'll see you after Thanksgiving. Again, my thanks to my good friend, EJ Henninger, for a great podcast today. We wish you all the best. We'll see you again very soon. Thanks so very much for tuning in. Remember, you can listen to the audio version. It will be released sometime before the weekend on all the major and some minor podcast platforms that we don't even know about, but all the major podcast platforms we know are on all of those. So you can listen to us at your convenience. So you can always download it on your own from our Podomatic website, or listen to it on our website at the number 5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. If you're listening to the audio, we're going to be right back with some announcements right after these words. As always, please stay tuned. For those leaving, thanks for joining us. We'll see you real soon. Have a happy holiday. You're listening to 5-Alarm Task Force.
Psst. Yeah, you. It's me, your heart. Listen to me. We've got to talk. High blood pressure is serious, and yours? Whoa, what happened to us? We used to be so much more active, but lately you've been ignoring me. I know you think I'm just gonna keep ticking away forever, but you're wrong. You can do so much more to control your high blood pressure. Doing the minimum isn't doing enough. I'm under a lot of pressure and can quit whenever I want. Bet you didn't know that. But I like my job. Just treat me better. Check on me. Give me something green to nibble on every once in a while. And maybe we can do some exercise on occasion. Let's get to it. After all, we're in this together.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Remember when you were a young boy or girl and someone bullied or teased you? Where do you most often turn? Like many of us, you turn to your family. If you're a first responder, you probably no longer worry about those childhood problems. But there are plenty more that can affect us. Lack of sleep, the tragedy and horror we often see, even life's everyday stumbling blocks, like family illness, money, job problems, and more. So where do you turn now? Your gut reaction might be to keep it to yourself and not tell anyone about the hell you're going through. However, that's not going to help you or anyone else. Instead, you could start with your second family, someone you work with at the firehouse, on the ambulance, or at the station. You spend a lot of time with them, and most of them understand many of the problems you're dealing with. Reach out to a coworker or an officer you trust. Speak to clergy at your house of worship, or contact your CISM team. Don't keep it inside, gnawing away at you. That's not good for you or anyone around you. Know that there are people who stand ready to listen to you and help you without passing judgment. Remember, to carry out your oath to protect life and property, the first life you have to care for is your own. Brought to you by 5-Alarm Task Force, along with the Critical Incident Stress Management Team in your area, close by and confidential.
We're really glad to have you listening to 5-Alarm Task Force, but we also want you to know that there are some other terrific fire service podcasts available. Here's the short list. Kahneman Radio with Lieutenant Jason Liska. B-Shifter with Chief John Vance. Do Your Damn Job with Battalion Chief Jacob Johnson. The Professional Brotherhood with Chief Brian Soller. Flow and Vent. B-A-R, Brotherhood Academy Radio with Nick Hilton and crew. DTFF, Down to Fight Fire, British Columbia Volunteers. SA Matters, Situational Awareness Matters, with Chief Richard Gassaway. Jump Seat Radio with Captain Ryan Pennington. Pin the Cue. Drone Responders. Make Do with Captain Nick Peppard and Sean Duffy. Thin Red Line with Battalion Chief John Hayowick. Average Jake Firefighter. Fit to Fight Fire. Remember, to be a great firefighter, you must be always willing to learn. This message is brought to you by 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. One mission, one family. First responders helping each other.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
And that wraps this episode of 5 Alum Task Force, brought to you by 5 Alum Task Force Corp. One family, one mission, first responders helping each other. We'd like to thank our guest, Captain E.J. Henninger, for joining us to discuss being both a volunteer firefighter and being a fire protection systems engineer. Do you know that you can find us and subscribe to us on all the top podcast platforms? Just search for 5 Alum Task Force. We also want to thank our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, the Firehouse Tribune, and LifeScan Wellness Centers, as well as our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Responder Wipes, Hass Alert, Nesta Bars, the EFT Corporation, 911lifestyle.com, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. If you'd like to be a guest with us or have a suggestion for a show, please drop us a line to info@5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 5 Alarm Task Force, on Facebook at facebook.com/5, A as in Apple, T as in Tango, F as in Foxtrot, and C as in Charlie. And on YouTube, please subscribe to our channel, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. Stay up to date with all the news about our podcast, our new nonprofit foundation, and our blog on our website, www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and let's make sure everyone goes home.